and welcome to Book City Roanoke. I'm Douglas Jackson, and we're here for episode 10 in the first season, and I'm happy today to be speaking with Roanoke-based writer Jean Larson. But before we start the conversation, I want to tell you a couple of things. This Book City Roanoke podcast is brought to you by our founding sponsor, Book No Further, Roanoke's independent bookstore, putting ideas in your head since 2017 down on the Roanoke City Market at 112 Market Street. Brad Stevens of Agape Podcast is providing production support. Book City Roanoke is a lab for the exploration of engagement and equity at the intersection of books and place. Explore our things literary at bookcityroanoke.com. This season on the podcast, we're taking a look at identity in action, how the written word helps us shape our understanding of ourselves, and then helps us put that into action in the world around us. Jean Larson, Professor Emeritus of English at Hollins University, is the author of books. They include many novels, essays, translations, and most recently, a collection of poems, What Penelope Chooses, which received the Cider Press Review Book Award and was published by that press. Thanks for being here, Jean Larson.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
First, I want to start off with your website, which very clearly defines you. It says right at the top, Jean Larson, writer. What does that say about you?
Well, it is central to who I am. And I think it's because of the quiet, connected feeling that comes when we write. The immersion in that. Or when we build websites, which was completely new territory for me, even with an easy template. But the idea that there would be this thing, this amateurish-looking but enthusiastic, slightly garrulous website, when I've fixed things up. Not only that, like a poem, like a novel, unlike an interview, you can keep going back and fiddling with it. And I love that part about it, too. So the writer was getting that label out there, and also distinguishing myself, speaking of identity, from the other Jean Larsons. There was a florist in Salt Lake City who spelled her name the same way, etc. So you need to find the words that put who you are as you perceive yourself out there into the world.
Great. I think you should occasionally order flowers from that florist.
Well, yes.
And she should
buy a book.
Maybe we'll just send her one.
Yeah.
Well, that quiet connectedness, can you talk a little bit more about that? And what does it feel like to you when you're writing?
Yeah, because that's the important part, I think. I have a careerist streak. I love it when people want to read my poems or are forced to read my poems for some reason, and maybe something happens. So communication is important. But the best part is what Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, the cognitive scientist, wrote about back in the 90s, that flow zone. Runners get it. Every kind of artist gets it, but scientists get it. When the astronomer is pulling the data together, she understands something, I think. And when you're writing, for me, and I know for everybody this is not unusual, there's a sense of being in the now and focused in a way that literally someone I love very much might walk into the room and I look up kind of vaguely. I've never actually said, have we met? But there's a kind of, there's a world out there afterward. It's a precious thing. And I hope, as a writer and a teacher, to make doorways for other people to get there.
And is that something that in your writing practice you look forward to? You attain it all the time?
Not all day. and of course, there's also a part of the final long-term process where you edit and you're much more kind of self-critical and analytical, and that is important. But I think writers learn their tricks for getting into that zone. Sometimes it's the early morning writing. For some people, it's a particular place. Being aware of that is good. There are also dangers that if you become too dependent on, I have to have things just this way. but finding the path to that in an open way and not a kind of obsessive regimented way, that seems to be the goal.
Right. How would you say writing has helped you develop a better understanding of yourself?
Well, for me, I think it's in part because I don't think of myself as an autobiographical writer. I lie a lot. And I'm not, I mean, I prefer fiction. I have written a few essays, but that's not my strong suit. And there is certainly, in many poems of mine, and I, who is writing about some experience that Jean Larson, in fact, had when she was driving on the interstate through the Shenandoah Valley. But I'm not trying to tell the story of my life in the way that writers I have great regard for, or love for, might do. I don't know what I'm doing, but it is a putting to, it has to do with the nature of the self, that we are word constructs, right? Who we are. And in building up a fictive story for me and many other writers, I think we get closer to that truth than with that other road through writing that let me tell you about what happened when I was 11 and how it shaped me. Mm-hmm. I'm glad we don't do it all the same. I'll do it the same way.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
How about in your relationship with the world around you, with other mm-hmm. people, as you're developing characters, as you're creating a world, mm-hmm. Does it help you better understand the characters around us in this world and our relationship to them?
I think so. I think if I'm working on a novel, I'm certainly, when all is going well, and I'm open to things in the world, I'm more attentive to them because on one level, I'm always looking for that idea, that key, that image, that thing that might pop me into an idea for what to do about the plot dilemma I'm chewing on in the back of my head. So it's a kind of selfish openness, but I'm not thinking about the grocery list or whatever. And I think that's a good thing.
Well, and you mentioned novels. You're a novelist, you're an essayist, you're a translator, mm-hmm. and you're certainly a poet. And mm-hmm. you have a new collection out, What Penelope Chooses. And I think it's a hoot and a joy and a treat, and it's certainly a treat to hear you read from it. And I'd love it if you'd read a poem for us.
Oh, I'd be delighted to ask a poet to read a poem. So these poems, I like to call them kind of sassy lyrical footnotes to Homer. And I am responding to various events and characters within mostly the Odyssey, but a little bit the Iliad. The one I thought I'd read, I kind of made up. It certainly has Odysseus washing up on an island, as he does more than once in his journey. But I invented a dream for him that's not in Homer. And I decided to read this one because it is about how we deal with language. What I'm imagining in the situation of the poem is, here's Odysseus was, of course, not writing dependent, or illiterate, if you want to use that term. And what would it mean to someone like him, like Homer as we imagine him to have been, to come in contact with written language, which has been so important to me from literally before I can remember, thanks to a mother who read to me. So this poem gives us my imagined dream that Odysseus has when he comes to an island. And like the other poems in the book, the title runs right into the first line. This is a dream Odysseus tells nobody, bless his heart. He sails a subterranean landscape, choppy hills and gore-warm flux, own shadow for gnomon, no compass but a great bear rudely wheeling, grown sun arift, and he unhinged, his self-sufficient wife a border too far. Within this contingent fluid topography, the only trails are bladed algal seaweed, brown, red, yellow, green. He nears the littoral. Waves push him in. up to the escarpment, animal tracks, trees' limbs blown down. He snatches a stick, scratches marks the dream has sent. Tells himself they mean man of tropes and wrenching, mean wisdom, maybe, mean no memory, no gods. His dry mouth starts to shape them, not because he ought to. Then he wakes.
Thank you. I'm Douglas Jackson, and you're in Book City, Roanoke. That was Jean Larson reading from What Penelope Chooses. These are the kinds of conversations that books help us have. Book No Further, Roanoke's independent bookstore, is a great spot to have them. Stop in down at Roanoke City Market and peruse the well-curated assemblage of new and gently used books. And yes, talk about some of the ideas they hold. That was terrific, following your comment about us being a construct of words, our identity. He nears the literal. I can imagine me nearing the literal. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'd be terrified.
Well, I'm proud of the pun there too, because, and that of course is something that written language lets us do, because I can write littor, ol, I think, meaning that area on the beach, sort of where the waves wash. But I'm hoping people will simultaneously hear the word literal and therefore hear its opposite, metaphorical, and run after that rabbit. Yeah. And books let us do this.
Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful to read that poem, but your language, you really do have to hear it too, or read it aloud.
Well, that's what makes it poetry.
Exactly.
I'm a great fan of that.
And let me ask you, you just made a comment too about your mother reading to you. Can you talk a little bit about how this love first started?
Well, I don't remember, but my mother was 40 when I was born, and my younger brother was born soon after. I bet she was tired a lot. And she was herself, had been a teacher from a family of teachers. And she gave me that great gift, let's sit down and read. We never went off to the doctor, which always involved, of course, sitting in the waiting room with two antsy kids without books. And she read to me every night. She put a book in my hands and claims I taught myself to read, although I know perfectly well that there's a little bit of wonderful maternal myth-making there. She did allow us, how she explained to me, that sometimes the letters mean one sound and sometimes another, and the vowels are tricky or something. But I do think that's the great gift any of us can give to kids we know, that we can go to a place like Books No Further and buy children's books for our nephews, nieces, grandchildren, neighbor kids, our own offspring, whoever, stepkids, whoever it is, and say, check this out. This is worth it. And it takes time sitting there and answering questions and dealing with the wiggliness. And my mom did that for me. I'm mighty grateful.
That is a gift. And not only bookstores, but our libraries in
Absolutely.
Town and the Star City Reads program. We heard earlier in the season from Marissa Mazek Blankenship.
Oh, yeah.
And she talked about all the work they're doing and putting books in the hands of young people and helping adults know how to engage young people that way. And if you think about it, you know, if you go further, say the next generation, what's our community going to be like with even more readers? How does it change when someone says, oh, you really taught yourself how to read. You're really good at that. You have a special relationship with words. What does that do for someone?
It was a useful myth. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we all need some useful myths. Hmm. Yeah. Every day.
Yeah.
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 So you spent a career at Hollins working with young people and people at a very particular time in their life as they're exploring new things, whether it's a young woman who's just started on campus in her college career, or if it's graduate students in the creative writing program exploring further exploring the relationship with words. Can you reflect a little bit on what that's been like for you?
I was so lucky to have that job. My joke is, so reading was something I was good at early, back to the mother myth, and I didn't go any further, but it worked out just fine, that I became a professional reader, and in some way, although I certainly did not feel like my student's mother at all, ringmaster at the circus was one of my favorite analogies. I did have a chance to do that work that the librarians, the community workers, the bookstore owners, the writers, readers, families do, of saying, look at this, think about it, develop pattern recognition, which I think is one of the highest forms of intelligence, right? And what we all want, and in an analytical sort of literature mode, which we certainly apply in creative writing classes too, pattern recognition balanced with or woven with critical thinking skills, so that the pattern doesn't become a dingbat conspiracy theory for the world, but rather a kind of judicious perception / creation of connections. That's what gives our life meaning, right? And ultimately, that's more than this particular poem or story draft in a workshop or this novel in a lit course. Matters more than those things. What are we saying about who we are, about how the world works? And Holland's classroom gave me a place to learn that from my students while I was trying to trick them into thinking I actually knew something and that they should listen up and then come back and tell me the way it really was.
I think that was actually a question about what you've learned from your students that you didn't see on my list, and it's there.
Quite a lot.
And we underestimate a lot of the value in courses in the humanities and in a liberal arts education, and that they really do just that, help us think critically and be prepared to be in the world around us as successful adults. Mm-hmm. But some of that's kind of on the bet. You think, you almost don't realize it's happening as it's happening, and then you reflect back years later. But do you see any of it happening in the classroom? Can you think of instances where you really saw someone, take that growth leap in front of your very eyes?
Yeah, I don't have a particular story for you, but I can testify that it does happen. And one of the joys of working at a smaller university is that I would see the same student, even in the course of 2 years, and certainly over four, just open up. And it has something to do with the time of life of the traditional aged undergrad or the typical MFA student, more likely to be in their 20s. But there are so many exceptions, and of course the students who come to school later with more experience enrich it. So what happens, I think it is sometimes a click, boom, flash, but it's more often an unfolding, more often that slow move from September to late November that I think I found the richest.
And recently, just this year, I decided to start memorizing poetry, and I never,
yes,
for some reason, I made it through life so far and hadn't had to do that, and just really found such pleasure in it. And I've got a goal for how many poems I'm trying to read this year. But I was amazed at how it deepened my connection to the words of the poem, to the idea, to the poet itself, and maybe go deeper and read more and try to understand more. But I find myself calling on those words in unexpected places.
Because you've gone more deeply with them. And I think particularly, I'm so glad you're doing that. Everyone should. I think because with poetry, and a Shakespeare play will do, but it's not just that you're enhancing your neural net with more connections, which will be great as the brain ages, right? There's one reason to do it. But it's because you're working more associatively that poetry, whether or not it's rhymed, there are all those sound links and image links, so that we're, in our culture, we put so much emphasis on the important work of thinking analytically and linearly. But reading with your ear the way memorizing poetry makes you do, in particular, seems important. I was lucky. My very first teaching experience was in Taiwan, and I felt like one of my primary qualifications was that I was a native speaker of English. And so I for sure read the poetry aloud to my students, and I never stopped. And it's hard because, oh, it's so important to discuss the themes and the structure and what's going on. But no, and the last lit course I taught at Hollands was a modern poetry class. And one of the students on an anonymous evaluation, one of the things that she had loved about the class was, I learned it's important to read poetry out loud. And I thought, okay, my work is done here.
And you're not just writing poetry, but do you write poetry every day? Is it part of the mix every day?
Oh, I wish it were, but yeah. No. I'm bingier than that. I admire the discipline of the writers who do it. And who knows, I may be able to move in that direction more now. I like when there's a rhythm for it. But the fact is there are stretches when I'll aim toward that and times when I don't.
And this collection was written over a period of time.
Yeah, maybe about 5 years, mm-hmm. really, which feels short to me in my old ladyhood. But it was the longest real sequence I've done. So once, I didn't know I was going to write a book, but I thought I'll do a few poems because I've been doing this academic stuff with the Odyssey. Why not reuse my research? And then the possibilities kept coming, and then the structure was there with obvious holes in it for me to fill in. I also completely recast the form of the poems, and then I was working every day in a really happy way because I had stuff to edit in the most creative, makingly possible way.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are you working on now?
Well, I've hauled out some old poems, and I'm redoing them. And I realize I learned something writing this book. I'm missing that sense of a form. These poems are all kind of busted sonnets. Mm. And it's like the 1590s in London right now. Everyone's writing sonnets. But that gave me something to do. And reconsidering these older poems, I think, great, I've got a goal. I'm headed on.
Terrific. And then mostly poetry now, or are you working on another novel?
Well, I do have a novel I want to get back to. Mm-hmm. I've been doing a tremendous amount of paperwork and office cleaning and all of those retirement things that unfortunately I did not do last spring because you haven't mentioned lack of procrastination among my virtues. So I'm pretty much done with that business, and I think I will soon go back to that novel, and we'll see what happens there.
I think you're always writing up there in that marvelous head of yours. Well, thank you, Jean Larson, for spending this time with us here at Book City Roanoke, where we're talking about identity and action. We want to thank our sponsor, Book No Further, on Roanoke's historic city market. And you can find Our Things Literary, such as author interviews and an inventory of local book clubs and local writers at bookcityroanoke.com.